who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I guess spring is coming. I saw the mouse this weekend. I forgot to mention it. Last night I said to Louise, hey, I saw the mouse on Sunday. Thomas Jefferson outside the window. You can see a picture of a similar one if you drop into our chat room. Go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. Welcome to the program, my friends. Patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Here we are, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. The Tom Hartman radio program on this beautiful 16th of March, the day after the Ides of March. And we survived it. We, you know, nobody got stabbed in the gut, as far as I know, as happened to Julius Caesar so long ago on the floor, on the steps of the Senate. Although Robert Feynman, who has a blog at robertfeynman.com, sends me a note. He says the next recession officially started today. General Motors announced a loss the first quarter. Stock hit a 12-year low. They've already announced plant closings. You know the drill. High oil, gas guzzlers, layoffs, declining tax revenues, rising social service costs, falling stock market inflation result general misery. He says, if you start talking about it on your show, you'll be seen prescient and will be invited onto Smart Money in 6 months. Well, thank you, Robert. Maybe you will be, because I'll give credit where credit is due. But I've been saying for years, I mean, on the radio here now for 3 years, and I've been saying to, you know, in writing, in my writings, for example, in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which I wrote back in the late 90s, and in op-ed pieces and whatnot that I was even writing in the 80s, I've been saying that basically ever since the so-called Reagan Revolution and supply-side economics and the war against organized labor in the United States that was declared by the Republicans in 1980 when Ronald Reagan, with the help of the Iranians, the Iranian hostage takers, and William Casey and George Herbert Walker Bush, when Ronald Reagan took over the White House, that was the beginning of the end of the American middle class, at least until people wake up and take their country back, which I think we're right on the verge of, frankly. I really do. But in any case, I would say that for those people who work for a living, for those people who make less than the average of the median income, 50, 60, 30, depends on which numbers you're using, somewhere between $30,000 and $60,000 a year, or in that range or less, there's been a recession going on for 20 years because the purchasing power and the overall income of the average working person in the United States has been on a steady decline ever since Ronald Reagan was elected president. And this isn't some liberal rant. This is, you know, basic numbers from the Congressional Research Service, the Office of Management and Budget, the Census Bureau. The numbers are there. Nobody's disputing it. Now, you will hear cons say, oh, but the economy's been doing great these last 25 years. Look at this. The stock market is up. The rich are getting richer. Warren Buffett's, and Bill Gates, look at how much they're worth. Sure. If you're worth millions, your worth millions has been getting larger and larger. So, anyhow, that's a whole kind of another rant and in another area, but wanted to make that point here. Not necessarily a story today, though. The big news for the day, it seems, is Wolfie. It's Wolfieville. Now the World Bank is going to be Wolfieville. Up until now, it's been the Pentagon. See, in my opinion, what's going on here, Paul Wolfowitz, by the way, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, number two guy in the Defense Department, and the architect of the quick, fast, easy, painless, going to cost less than $2 billion, be paid for out of oil revenue, war in Iraq. The one that wasn't going to involve any American casualties. The one that was going to bring together the world. The one that was going to bring democracy to the Middle East. Good old Wolfie. Yasser Arafat's death has had a lot to do with democracy, the beginnings of democracy in the Middle East, I would suggest. But even that, you know, this is They've got conservatives writing headlines now. It's freedom's on the march. Wouldn't it be nice? I think it'd be wonderful if democracy came to the Middle East. We're slowing it down with our war in Iraq. We have become a lightning rod for every terrorist in the world. I mean, I digress. Let me get back to this. In my opinion, what's going on is that Bush is tired of taking heat from people in his own party. You've got former Voting Machine Corporation CEO Chuck Hagel, formerly the president of the company that became ES&S, the second largest voting machine company in America, as I recall. Folks like Chuck Hagel, who wants to become president in 2008, presumably on voting machines, the same way he became senator from Nebraska after he sold the voting machines to the state of Nebraska. The company was headquartered in Nebraska, still is, as far as I know. You got folks like Chuck Hagel and John McCain criticizing these so-called neocons like Wolfie, these disciples of Leo Strauss. Wolfie is actually one of the few who actually studied under Leo Strauss in the University of Chicago. Leo Strauss, the guy who advanced the idea that the ends justify the means, that you have to lie to the American people in order to accomplish greater goods, or a greater good. And so anyhow, Wolfowitz being moved. Now, Doug Feith has announced that he's going to be retiring in a few months. My sense of it is that the neocons are being moved out of the Defense Department, and that this is part of the Republican Party's pre-positioning for the 2006 elections. Because, I mean, what the World Bank, there's two major international institutions, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. By tradition, the World Bank, the head of the World Bank is appointed by the United States, and traditionally it's an American. And the reason for that is that the United States is the largest stockholder in the World Bank. We contribute most of the money to it. And the mandate for the World Bank is to reduce poverty around the world. And the way that they've done this is by funding things like giant power plants and boondoggle operations that have raised oligarchies and have done, frankly, very little to reduce poverty around the world. The World Bank has had some mind-bogglingly spectacular failures. And a few successes, but the true successes in reducing poverty that have involved finance have been in the area of micro-lending. This is the area where these banks have been set up in Bangladesh and Pakistan and India in particular, where they make loans of $10 to $100 to literally peasants, people who would refer to themselves as peasants, so that they can start their own little businesses, little sewing operations or little water purification, water pump, you know, whatever, just small microloans. And they've been tremendously successful. The World Bank's had nothing to do with that. But in any case, the mandate of the World Bank is to reduce poverty. And the mandate of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, whose leader is traditionally appointed by the Europeans, although the Europeans can veto the IMF, I'm sorry, the Europeans can veto the World Bank head, and the Americans can veto the IMF head, as Clinton did, by the way. What was his name? I'm forgetting it. Chow Kok Wesser was put forward by the Europeans to head the International Monetary Fund. Bill Clinton shot it down. He said, this guy isn't strong enough. So, you know, there's a history for doing this, and it's possible that the Europeans will say, Wolfie at the World Bank? Don't think we're going to go along with that. And in fact, in a BBC story today, they said essentially European leaders are mind-boggled by the appointment of Wolfie, of Paul Wolfowitz, to be the head of the World Bank. I'm paraphrasing, not quoting. And in fact, the New York Times article by David Stout, European leaders who dislike Mr. Wolfowitz may be tempted to defy tradition and contest the nomination. He also adds, Mr. Wolfowitz is not widely regarded as an expert on development. No, not at all. He's an expert on how to incompetently plan and execute a war. But he's George's guy. The BBC article noted this is twice in a couple of weeks here, nominating Condi, raised the eyebrows all over Europe. And now Wolfie, it's like all the hawks are being repaid for the brilliant job that they did in getting 1,500 of our soldiers killed and spending $200 billion of our treasure in causing 10, 15,000 of our soldiers to lose arms, legs, eyes, in killing over 100,000 innocent Iraqi civilians, not to mention those, quote, insurgents, end quote. And for what? Here we are, positioning ourselves as the world's greatest superpower, and we pick on a third-rate nation that didn't even have an air force, that had been hollowed out by 10 years of sanctions. Oh, we're tough. We're really tough. But Bush, you know, managed to elevate these guys to the level of super villain status so that he could become the superhero. Yeah, right. You want some supervillains? Talk to China. Talk to the Taiwanese about China. This is Mandy Borowitz, Borowitz Report. White House reporter turns out to be, well, I won't reveal it in the headline. I'll give it to you in the story. The White House press corps was rocked by another scandal today as a man thought to be a professional journalist was revealed to be Vice President Dick Cheney wearing a fake mustache. The shocking discovery took place during a daily briefing at the White House, in which spokesman Scott McClellan took the following question from a reporter he referred to only as Herb. The reporter said, "Wouldn't you agree that President Bush's plan for reforming Social Security totally rocks?" Before Mr. McClellan could respond to the question, the reporter's mustache suddenly fell off his face, revealing him to be none other than Vice President Cheney. Mr. Cheney, unaware that his disguise had fallen off and seemingly oblivious to the audible gasps of the journalists in the room, continued, "And wouldn't you agree that anyone who opposes it hates our country?" After asking, "And isn't everything in Iraq going really well these days?" the vice president noticed that his fake mustache was on the carpet at his feet. He then quickly excused himself and bolted from the room. Hours after the incident, the White House took great pains to explain Mr. Cheney's dual role as Vice President of the United States and obsequious journalist. Mr. McClellan told reporters, "For the past 3 years, we have consistently stated that Vice President Cheney has been in a secret, undisclosed location. The location was, in fact, the White House press room." Elsewhere, notes Andy Borowitz, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said she would not run for president in 2008. Quote, "Unless the Democrats nominate somebody really easy again," end quote. So we will see. Hey, the Burlington Free Press got it right. Tim in Illinois, you can stop your phone calls to the editor. You will be very pleased to hear this about what's happening with Bush and Mercury and all this. I'll share that with you right after this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, News Without Conflicts of Global Corporate Interest.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Little village, baby, here large enough to be a town. From a little village, baby, here large enough to be a town.
Van Morrison. Welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman radio program. Does anyone remember why Social Security was invented, asked Gene Messick. Answer, because the stock market crashed. Question, who is the chief proponent of investing Social Security money in the stock market? Answer, an AWOL former alcoholic who failed at every business he tried. Question, why does he constantly proclaim that Social Security is bankrupt? Answer, because bankruptcy is the only part of business he understands. Question, why 3 years ago did you buy a short, painless war in Iraq from this man? Answer, then why would you trust anything else he tells you? Fooled once, shame on him. Fooled twice, shame on you. Well, or as Bush would say, well, I I can't even remember his garbled version of it. It's really quite extraordinary. A remarkable success story here, the Burlington Free Press's report on mercury. This is quite remarkable. And I know that one of our listeners, our regular listeners and callers, Tim, is going to be very pleased with this. Before I move on to it, though, let's take a call here. Go to the lines just in the event that it has to do with Wolfie, which topic we just sort of wrapped up. 26 minutes past the hour. Number 1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to call in. Also, if you want to drop into the chat room, the live chat room, which is working just fine. Turned out the entire internet yesterday had one of these brownouts, or a good chunk of it. I mean, you know, like big pieces of the East Coast or something, which caused about a 15-minute burp in our chat room toward the middle part of the last hour of our program. In any case, everything's up and working just fine today. Derek in Woodbridge, Virginia on the line. Hey, Derek, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Just a non-sequitur here. I read this piece in Reuters, and McDonald's is going to outsource their drive-thrus to North Dakota.
Oh, this has been going on for some time. It's not just McDonald's. There are companies setting themselves up. Some of these fast food places are doing them in-house, and apparently others, there are companies setting themselves up to offer, you know, phone answering services for the drive-thrus.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's save a buck here, save a buck there. That's what it's all about. It's we really, Derek, need to go back to the idea in the United States that if you're going to do business in this country, you do business in a way that not only makes you money. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's a fine thing that people make money running a business. It's the reason why people go into business. But not only do you do that, but you also provide some social good, like well-paying jobs, not just a job that somebody can barely starve on or qualify for food stamps with.
But buy a meal to eat.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Derek, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Mark in Dallas, Texas on the line. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Yeah, I just want to let you know that Mr. Bartlett from Maryland, I believe he's a senator. He may be a representative, though. He read into the Congressional Record an hour-long speech on peak oil late Monday night.
Oh, Dan Bartlett.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And if people are interested in seeing that, they can go to a website called energybulletin.net. And the whole speech is reproduced there.
Yeah, I wrote a book about this in 1997 called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and I'm working on an op-ed piece I'm going to submit to Common Dreams this weekend on it. Peak oil is once again a topic in the news as oil prices are going through the roof, and this is a real issue, and it's really here. And anybody who thinks it isn't,
the nice
is
thing about it being read in the Congressional Record, I mean, with all due respect to your book, Tom, is that at least it gives cover for people that want to claim that we're conspiracy nuts, because it's all there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And although there has been a lot of conspiracy nut stuff read into the Congressional Record over the years, just for the record, Mark.
But
I think it's a fine thing that Dan Bartlett did that. And I agree with him. And in fact, I would encourage our listeners to just simply plug peak oil into Google. And yeah, the first dozen hits, read them. It'll pop your eyeballs out of your head. Mark, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you down there in oil land in Dallas, Texas. 29 minutes past the hour. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. I'm Tom Hartman.
Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
In the good old USA, I'd just like to say, tomorrow's dreams are always coming true. And the whole blessed
world. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. I'm Tom Hartman here with you. And what I was trying to remember, and you'll now understand why I was having such a hard time remembering exactly what the words were. Or, you know, would you buy a used war from this man? George W. Bush about fool me once and et cetera.
There's an old saying in Tennessee. I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says fool me once, shame on you. It fool me, you can't get fooled again.
Fool me, you can't get fooled again. He, see, he's incapable of saying, shame, shame on me. It's not in his vocabulary. Anyhow, back to the Burlington Free Press. This is marvelous. I am so proud of my hometown newspaper, even if it is owned by Gannett, that as I shared with you last Friday, actually it was last Thursday that the story ran, and we discussed it on the air on Thursday, we discussed it on Friday with Bernie Sanders, the Burlington Free Press, Burlington, Vermont newspaper, which is the largest statewide newspaper, had run a front page story basically saying that the Democrats had succeeded in shooting down an effort by the Bush administration to cut mercury pollution in the air, which technically is correct. The Bush administration had put forward this thing called the Clear Skies Initiative, which would have cut mercury pollution. The only problem is there's already a law in place, a rule in place that Bill Clinton put into place that would cut mercury pollution by 90% within 3 years. And the Bush administration was trying to replace that with their Clear Skies Initiative, which would only cut it by 70% and wouldn't kick in until 2018. So, you know, it was a little deceptive. And so I know Tim in Illinois actually called the newspaper here in Vermont and said, what's up with this? And I understand they heard from a few Vermonters. We're on the air in two radio stations in Vermont as well. And, you know, so the word got around. And today, probably the lead story, or I'd say at least the number two story, the upper right-hand column, the headline, big letters, Vermont officials slap Bush on mercury, by Candace Page, Free Press staff writer. Well done, Candace. Environmental Conservation Commissioner Jeff Wenberg grew more and more agitated Tuesday as he talked, writes Candace Page. He was discussing a just-issued federal rule that delays deep reductions in mercury emissions and allows coal-fired power plants to buy and sell the right to pollute. This does not work, he explained finally. I am a Republican. I believe in market-based approaches. But to use the market to regulate a powerful neurotoxin, it's almost indefensible. Wenberg's reaction, writes Candace Page, was almost dispassionate compared to that of Senator James Jeffords, independent of Vermont. And then she quotes Jeffords saying, at the behest of industry, the Bush administration has just endorsed the continued poisoning of children and pregnant women with mercury, a substance so toxic that it causes birth defects and IQ loss. That's the first four paragraphs of the story. Isn't that great? Right there. Finally, somebody telling the truth and telling it's just doing a great job, stand-up job. Later on in the story, she points out the federal rule issued Tuesday represents the nation's first limits on mercury emissions from coal-burning power plants. Critics immediately cried that the rule subverts the Clean Air Act, which they said requires limits on every power plant's emissions by 2008. That's the 3 years from now. And then she quotes Neil Kamen. Now, see, I'm sure that the right-wingers in this state will say, oh, liberal bias here. Look at this, liberal bias. They are writing an article that tells the truth, and the truth is uncomfortable for the Bush administration. Must be liberal. Got to be liberal bias. I'm sure that probably the editor, publisher of the Burlington Free Press is going to be getting, you know, rants in email and telephone calls from right-wingers. So you might want to give them a shout and say, hey, well done. With existing technology, we could achieve 90% reductions now, says Neil Kamen, Chief Lake Assessment Specialist for the Department of Environmental Conservation. That's here in the state of Vermont. Instead, the Bush administration rules are intended to produce a 50% reduction after 15 years, rather than a 90% reduction in 3 years. So, well done, well said. 1-866-889-8894, telephone. Let's go back to the phones for a moment here. Trey in North Carolina on the line. Hey, Trey, what's on your mind?
I have a quick question. It shouldn't take too long. It's about the per capita abortions being up under Bush.
Right, yeah. The absolute number of abortions has gone up under President Bush. But truth be told, it tends to go up whenever poverty goes up and whenever the economy gets worse. Plus, there are some pretty good studies that appear to show that when you stop teaching birth control and you stop teaching sex education in public schools in ways that includes birth control, that you end up with more unwanted pregnancies. So the Bush administration, you could argue, has been responsible for a measurable and significant increase in abortions over the last few years. Yes.
And that's what I was calling about. I wanted to know if you, like, knew any, like, sources where I could find the actual studies about this.
Yeah, Planned Parenthood. It has done some pretty good stuff, and they've compiled some good information on their website, which I'm assuming is PlannedParenthood.org, but you might want to plug it into Google just to make sure. But Planned Parenthood, they're not, NARAL.org, the what used to be called the National Abortion Rights League, and now they've just renamed themselves as NARAL, N-A-R-A-L. I'm sure that they would probably have the same information, but you could argue that they have a pro-abortion agenda. The Planned Parenthood group really. You know, they're not about abortions. They're about planning whether or not you want to have children, you know, birth control and helping, you know, that kind of thing. And if abortion's legal, then they give out information on it. And if it's illegal, then they don't. I mean, they're not an advocacy group for anything other than planning the size of your family appropriately and reducing the number of street kids and orphans and abortions. And so I would say if you want something that you could present to somebody else as being relatively unbiased, I'd go to the Planned Parenthood website. Okay?
Yeah, because I'm trying to, like, convince a lot of Christians, you know, that voting for Bush is actually not good and they're interested in the first place. And so,
well, you know, this was the point that John Kerry made during the election. You know, he said he's a Catholic. He was personally opposed to abortion, and his personal religious belief is that, you know, abortion is murder. That's the Catholic position. That's John Kerry's personal position. But he said, you know, as a government official, he has to enforce the law, and the law says that it's legal. And he said, but, you know, the goal of both the law and the religion is to reduce the number of abortions. And the way you reduce the number of abortions is by reducing the number of unwanted pregnancies. And the way you reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies is by giving women in particular, although men as well, but particularly giving young people who are, you know, of reproductive age, and certainly they're gonna start behaving sexually. It's not gonna, you can't hold it off forever. You can maybe with a few of them who are living in cloistered communities at the Jerry Falwell Center for whatever. But in any case, by giving them information about birth control and how it works and all that kind of stuff. And so Kerry was right.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call, Trey. Good to hear from you. Brad in Columbia, Missouri on the line. Hey, Brad. Hey, by the way, was it you, Brad, who emailed me that Missouri is not a right-to-work state?
No, that was not me.
Okay, well, somebody sent me an email, and I believe I read it on the air yesterday. If I didn't, I've said it now. Somebody had called and said that they thought Missouri was a so-called right-to-work state, and apparently it's not. So, anyhow, what's up, Brad?
Well, I'm in light of the vote last week on the bankruptcy bill.
Yes,
and the prominent role that money plays, in our politicians' hands. For example, Joe Biden, who's generally a good guy, he's got an MBNA sitting there in his front yard. I'm sure there's something I don't understand about the political process, but I don't understand why progressives, the liberals, are not pushing more to separate politics from big money. And I'm thinking of in the form of publicly financed campaigns rather than the system that we've got now.
Yeah, there's a significant push to make that happen, although, frankly, the Green Party is leading it more effectively than the Democrats or Republicans. But such reforms have actually happened in the state of Maine and I believe in Arizona. And the result of it has been, particularly in Maine, I know of Maine for sure, that all of a sudden, this is just a state, just at the state level, all of a sudden there are a lot of people who didn't come from money and didn't come from the political elite, as it were, who not only have run for office, but gotten elected for office. You know, state senators, state representatives, things like that. And it has been a remarkable and tremendous opening up of the political system. And these are the sorts of changes that, frankly, I don't think you're going to see at the national level. I mean, there have been attempts. Certainly, Russ Feingold and John McCain have been working on this for years and years. Granny D, you know, on her 90th birthday, walked across America for campaign finance reform 5-6 years ago. I mean, there's been a real push for this, but frankly, I don't think that it's going to happen at the federal level in time for anything significant. But there is a lot of activity, a lot of activity. I mean, in hundreds of communities around the United States, and certainly in several states at the state level, to bring about local financing, you know, government financing of elections, or to limit the amount of contributions. Here in Vermont, in fact, the Supreme Court just upheld our campaign finance laws, which say that the, you know, candidates are limited to a certain number of dollars that they can spend in a campaign, and they and there are limits on how much money can be given to them to open up the process to people of modest means and to get corporate money out of it. This is a campaign really that Teddy Roosevelt started, you know, back in the 1905. In 1907, he passed the first federal law saying that it was a felony for a corporation to give money to a political candidate. And that law is still on the books, by the way, but it's by and large not enforced.
It seems like to me that would create a sea change in the political face of America.
Oh, it would, Brad.
It seems like to me that a Democrat going around the country promoting that people would buy it. You know, that, hey, let's separate money, big money, from politics so we have a fair representation for everybody in the country.
Yeah, the big problem that you face, certainly at a federal level with this, Brad, is the 1978 Supreme Court case called Boston versus Bilotti. And this was a Supreme Court case where the First National Bank of Boston decided to get involved in a political campaign. And there was a state law in the state of Massachusetts that said that a corporation can't contribute money to a candidate or to a campaign unless it directly affects that corporation. In other words, if there was a law to regulate banks, then the bank could get involved in lobbying against it. But this had nothing to do with banking. But the bank wanted to get involved anyway, and they did. And Frank Bilotti, the Attorney General of Massachusetts, sued the bank and said, you can't do this. And so the bank took it to the Supreme Court, thus the name First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti. And the Supreme Court, on a 5-4 decision, ruled that because back in 1886, in a case called Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, the Supreme Court had ruled that corporations are persons under the law and therefore entitled to protections under the Bill of Rights, that corporations have First Amendment rights of free speech, and that includes political speech, because the free speech rights in the First Amendment really were intended for political speech more than anything else. And that because a corporation, even though it's a person, doesn't have a mouth like you and I do, they have to have some way of speaking, and so money is their way of speaking. And that 1978 decision kicked open the door for the Republicans in the Reagan campaign to come in with mind-boggling amounts of cash, largely from the oil industry, which is why Reagan's first official act of office was to remove the solar collectors that Jimmy Carter had put up on the roof of the White House, and to come into office on just this screaming pile of corruption and start trickle-down economics and start reversing the 50-year flow of history in the United States of more and more egalitarianism, more and more power for the middle class, a better lifestyle for the middle class, flipped that around and turned it into the rich get richer and the poor get poorer and the middle class starts to vanish. And
therein lies our problems right now.
Absolutely. And it all boils down to the Supreme Court having ruled back in 1886 that corporations are persons. And here's the interesting part. It turns out back in 1886, the Supreme Court ruled no such thing. They didn't actually rule that. It's the corrupt former president of a railroad who was the clerk of the court wrote that in a headnote, which had no legal status. And so now there's this movement across the United States to revoke corporate personhood. I wrote a whole book about this called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And it's also in my book, What Would Jefferson Do?, a whole chapter on this. And there is a movement nationwide now to roll back corporate personhood. We've got a bill that's being introduced here in the House of Representatives in Vermont. The state of Nebraska has actually passed a constitutional amendment. A bunch of communities, over 100 communities now in Pennsylvania, have passed laws. Point Arena, California, has passed an ordinance. So this is the real core of it. This is as you point out, Brad, it's all about the corruption of politics by money. And what has facilitated that is this bizarre notion that corporations are persons and have personhood rights. And that's where it stands. And it's going to take, just like with, you know, repealing, just like, you know, rolling back apartheid, integration, segregation in the United States, just like rolling back the disenfranchisement of women in the United States, which didn't happen, by the way, in 1776 or 1787, as Rush Limbaugh said on his program yesterday. He said, the Constitution said that only landowners could vote, and they had to amend the Constitution to fix that. He said that on the air yesterday. Nonsense. The Constitution gave women the right to vote. It gave everybody the right to vote. It was individual states that didn't. And it wasn't all the states. It was just a few of the states. But more and more of the states picked up on that as time went by. And that's why we ended up having a civil war and having to pass the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments in the 1860s. But in any case, I digress. The point is, we need to get money out of it. I agree with you.
Seems like this one thing, if we could push that, focus on that, it would work for the biggest change, for what we want.
I agree with you, Brad, and here's how you do it. In Missouri, you contact your two senators and your congressman or congresswoman there in Columbia, Missouri. You contact your local officials, find out who your state senators are, find out who your members of the House of Representatives in Columbia are, contact the Green Party and the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and let them know that you're interested in this issue. And sign up for the Democracy for America or any other group like that. Get involved, show up, make some phone calls, start writing letters to the editor of the newspaper. That's how change will happen. Brad, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
I guess I better.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It doesn't matter what they do. All that matters is my relationship to you.
Welcome to the radio home of democracy, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. I'm Tom Hartman. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jeff in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Even though I'm a Democrat, if you add up all the money spent on campaigns from dog catcher all the way to president throughout the whole country and put it in a giant pile, it adds up to about...
Jeff, I think we just lost you. It adds up to about something, but apparently you're calling on a cell phone and you just vanished. I'm sorry. We'll go to Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
He's floating in cyberspace.
Yeah, apparently.
Hey, Tom, I'm calling regarding about this Wall Street Journal article you talked about yesterday, the pro-business agenda.
Right.
By Brody Mullins. And as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, there they go again, how they frame language. It says pro-business agenda. And when you see a lot of small business people who are basically middle class reading this pro-business, they say, hey, that's me. I should vote Republican, when it's really pro big business agenda. And often you see, why do small business guys who are really middle class vote for Republicans? Because they think they're big business guys,
or they hope to be. I mean, there is that sense of hope springs eternal.
Right.
And if I own a business and I can make $50,000 this year, maybe I can make $100 next year, maybe I'll make $200 the year after that, and then the Wall Street Journal will be meaningful to me. That there's that kind of thinking that goes on, I think, among a lot of entrepreneurs.
Yeah, and you kind of, it goes into what's the matter with Kansas, why, the middle class and small business vote against their own economic interests. And often you realize, and that they, again, we have to explain to small business people, hey, you belong to the middle class. You're not part of the big boys.
Yeah, these are distinctions, by the way, that Teddy Roosevelt was the Republican Roosevelt back, 1905, 1906, 1900, from 1900 to 1908, basically, was very, very good at making. He said, we have no problem with the small business person in America, that he called the small businessman in America. We have no problem with the medium-sized businessman in America. He said, these people are the pillars of the community. They're the ones that help hold our social fabric together and produce the goods that we use and provide employment for people and all that kind of thing. He says, however, with big business, we have a problem. I'm quoting Teddy Roosevelt.
But
with
Bush
big business,
always
we have
about
a problem.
Small business, even though we know he doesn't represent them.
Well, and in fact, what's happened is that the small business associations, including, for example, here in Vermont, I'm a member of the Chamber of Commerce, and that's how I get my health insurance, because we're a small business, this radio show. It is dominated by multinational corporations.
I know.
They claim to represent small businesses.
Democrats have to make it clear that we represent not just labor, but small business.
There you go. Well said. Tom, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. You're in the middle of the vast, radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
There's further evidence. Welcome back, by the way, to my friends, to the radio support group of By and For We the People. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone high up in the Green Mountains of the People's Republic of Vermont, broadcasting on radio stations from Oregon and California to North Carolina and Virginia, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, now running our show 24/7, and, of course, CRN Digital in 29 states on cable systems and radio stations. Welcome back to the program. Here's a Paul Harvey moment for you. This is one of those, and now you know the rest of the story, factoids, shall we say. Not sure how else to describe it. Seth Sandrosky wrote in commondreams.org on Monday of this week. He was going through the Department of Labor's household survey. Oh, not Seth. Dean Baker, an economist, was, and Seth wrote about it. Dean Baker's going through the Labor Department compiles these statistics about, you know, who's working and who's doing what and all that kind of thing. And he discovers an interesting statistic. The Bush administration has been running around going, ain't it wonderful, since George W. became president, he's created 1,810,000 new jobs. Guess how many of them are people over the age of 55? Now, that would be, you know, I mean, generally when you think of new jobs being created, you're not thinking of people who are 55 and older. Not to slam basically my own age group. I'll be 54 in a few weeks. But in any case, not to slam my own age group. But basically, you think about people over 55, and you're closing in on the greeters at Walmart, right? Geez. I'm getting old here. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. Well, okay. All right. Internal parts, calm down. Over the last year, workers over the age 55 accounted for 918,000 of the 1.8 million jobs in the Labor Department's household survey. Says economist Dean Baker, this is a very striking and relatively new development. Now, why is this? Why is this that people who might otherwise have retired or who might otherwise have secure jobs are suddenly in the market for new jobs? Well, according to the statistics provided by the Labor Department in their household survey, economist Dean Baker points out there are two factors that have created this. The first is that a lot of retirees, a lot of people in their late 50s, in their 60s, in their late 60s, and in their 70s, and even in their 80s, are among these 918,000 people who have filled these new jobs that George W. is so proud of. Many of them are going back to work because their 401ks have been wiped out, either by overt fraud like MCI WorldCom or Enron, or by the fact that the stock market went when George W. became president. And so their retirement funds, they, you know, they had a nest egg and they don't anymore. So they're having to go back to work. That's one big variable. The other is that the falling value of the dollar and the rising U.S. dependence on foreign lending to fund private sector borrowing are leading to a trend of price hikes. Basically, the dollars become worth less. You could say that real fast. The dollars become worthless or becoming. And so it seems like the price of some things are going up. It seems like from the time George Bush became president until today, the price of gold went from $270 an ounce to $440 an ounce. It seems like oil went from $18 a barrel to $55, $56 a barrel yesterday. In fact, what has happened Is it the value, the cost of a barrel of oil and the value of an ounce of gold have remained relatively constant? I will give you that oil is becoming a little more precious a commodity, but gold certainly hasn't. Why are they more expensive? Because our dollars are worth less. And as our dollars are worth less, the cost of living, to the extent that our ability to live depends upon foreign imports, particularly oil, particularly fuel, whether it's fuel for your gasoline or whether it's heating oil for your home or whether it's buying products that are made with oil. I mean, you can't make anything pretty much without oil. Oil is producing electricity in the United States. Oil, you know, runs the steel mills, in some cases coal, but mostly oil. And on the list goes. That because the price of these things is going up, or the value of the dollar is going down, you could say it either way, that people's retirement incomes just don't go as far as they used to, and so people have to get new jobs. Now, you know, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. I've got some interesting news from the Wall Street Journal Day International Economic News that I want to get to. First, let's take a few phone calls. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jeff in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Jeff, we were talking to you in the last hour, and you just dropped off the face of the earth on your cell phone there.
I'm sorry about that, Tom. Great show as usual.
Thank you. Hopefully you're holding a signal here.
I won't drop off a hope.
Okay.
At any rate, what I wanted to talk about was finance reform on campaign finance reform. Like I said, if you add up all the money of all the campaigns in the country, it adds up to about what U.S. business spends on advertising, about 10 business days. I can't believe that we are telling the people that have an effect on our life, the right regulations, the right laws, tell them they can't advertise.
Yeah, I mean, it's really remarkable.
The most important sports in the United States from 1900 to 1975 was baseball and prize fighting. The American people
baseball
love
and
a
what?
Good fight. They love a good fight. Let's
oh, prize fight.
Party raise what they want.
Yeah.
And let's have a fight.
Yeah, I mean, here's the bottom line is if you look at it in terms of it sounds to me like what you're saying is that that our politicians being for sale cheap should not be of any concern to us. Is that what you're saying?
I think you should let them spend whatever they want.
Yeah. Well, see, I disagree. I think that if you right now there's this little checkoff box on your taxes where you can send $3 to the National Campaign Fund.
Right.
We spent about $1 trillion in the last election cycle, the last 4 years, in all the campaigns around the country. If you want to generate that amount of taxes, all you have to do is put about a $5 checkoff box once a year on people's taxes. And then you've got fully funded elections. And then anyone can run for office, and they don't have to come into office beholden to large corporations, or they don't have to spend their own money. I mean, look at John Corzine in New Jersey. He spent millions of dollars of his own money. Look at Bloomberg in New York. He spent $87 per vote. The guy he ran against that everybody thought was going to win spent $17 per vote. Hey, Bloomberg just outspent him. It's because he had the money. That's wrong. That's not democracy.
You know, I have 120 people that work for me, and it's very hard to run a business in the United States nowadays.
I agree. I mean,
the insurance tax policies, you deal with lawyers. I run a trucking company. I had 125 accident incidents last year. Where half of them weren't our fault. I got sued on every damn one of them.
Sure.
I don't understand why that is. I mean, that you have to sit there, even though it's not your fault, you have to sit there and spend money on an attorney so you don't defend yourself from losing everything you have.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. I mean, they need to change that.
Well, you know, I can't speak to your issues in the trucking industry. Frankly, I don't know about them. I'm sorry. But what I can speak to is campaign finance reform, which is what you called about. And my point is that if we had publicly financed elections rather than privately financed elections, which they by and large were up until the 1970s, they weren't absolutely, certainly this is, as I said, Teddy Roosevelt was ranting about this in the early 1900s, but the media were required to provide free airtime to candidates for office. And it was just considered the thing that you did. Newspapers are subsidized with our tax dollars. The distribution, the mailing of newspapers, they get a discount. Radio stations and TV stations, they get free airtime. Cable companies get free access to the rights of way, the telephone poles along our streets, and they're maintained by our tax dollars. And so we said to them, if you're going to do this, if you're going to make use of this, of the commons here, the stuff that we all own in common, then you're going to give some of your media access to those people who are running for political office so that we, the people, can be informed about our candidates. And basically, since Reagan did away with the Fairness Doctrine and Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act, and I consider them both villains in this, that's all been done away with. And so now it is, quite simply, the biggest honeypot. I mean, you say, you know, it's only 10 days worth of advertising for the United States. Well, there's a mind-boggling amount of advertising. The largest single source of revenue for media corporations is campaign advertising, and which means that they're not going to be interested in putting people running for public office out for free. They're going to want to extract as much money as they can from them. That's just not good for democracy. It's just not good for democracy.
I look at this way. Money has always run the United States, always will. Always has, always will.
It actually hasn't. If you go back to the people who signed the Constitution in 1787, two-thirds of them voted against their own economic interests in signing the Constitution.
I think I'm a pretty good man to work for, but I'll let my employees know, Tom, I hired you to make money off you. If you don't make me money, I'm going to look away to get rid of you now. I mean,
sure. Sure,
and
in that, Jeff, I honor you for being honest, because there are a whole lot of people out there who are saying, I'm giving you a job, like it's charity. And the reality is that employers hire employees because they can make more money off that employee than the employee costs them.
That's right. If it costs me money, I had a guy I had 15 years, and he started screwing around, and I said, I don't need you anymore.
Yeah.
He took me to court, but I told him, you know, the guy's losing me money.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I can't have that. I mean, his wife called and everything. I said, look, you know, he's not showing up for work. He's not doing his job. I can't tolerate that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not what I'm in business for, you know?
Yeah, but again, we're not, you know, and I, you know, I can't necessarily salute your business practices because I don't know them. But I do say it's good of you to say that you know, the reason that you're hiring people is because they're going to make you money. I mean, that's what business is all about. Yeah, but with regard to campaign finance reform, And I believe in democracy in the workplace. I think that your workers should have some say in the conditions under which they're working, which I suspect you would disagree with me on. But in any case, with regard to democracy in the United States, I think that one of the things that puts our democracy at greatest risk is the fact that people with the most money have the greatest say in this country. And that's not
that's
the ideal.
The golden rule.
That's not how this country was run for the first 100 years. That's why there are no dynasties that date back before the 1880s, because prior to that time, that was not the golden rule. Democracy was the golden rule, and that's what
Wouldn't you agree, Tom, that the vast majority of employment right now generated in the United States is generated by small business owners?
Because
I've had employees every year.
Yeah, that's according to the Small Business Association, that's the case. According to the federal government, small businesses generate the vast majority of new jobs. But the Bush administration is not helping small businesses. They're sucking up to big multinational corporations.
Jeff, we've got to
boogie along. I'm sorry, we're out of time, but I appreciate the call. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
We got a president so bad, gotta be the worst we ever had. Got the job because of his dad, now we're all in danger.
And we're all
he
bankrupt.
Come around up to no good, broke the old treaties cause he could. Struck us all around like a hood, got us in a world of trouble. Put him in a straitjacket, there's no doubt. Let the psychiatrist figure him out. Listen while the demonstrators cheer and shout. We'll all feel better in the morning.
Yes. Welcome back. And speaking of demonstrators cheering and shouting, a reminder, Saturday and Sunday there are going to be demonstrations all around the country, certainly all around the world, in protest of the second anniversary of the illegal invasion of Iraq by this administration. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website, 25 minutes past the hour. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is with us with our report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much. Okay. Couple things. One, I was at the press conference today, which I'll get into before. I just want to mention one thing, which is Ed Markey today put forth some legislation, or he plans to. I don't know if it's actually been filed yet. And he wants to make sure that anybody who has been given extraordinary rendition would, in fact, would not be allowed to send these people out to foreign countries, particularly with Guantanamo. So in other words, it would essentially end extraordinary rendition. Of course, the president was asked about that today, and he had, in my opinion, a very weak answer to that. He essentially said, well, it's a post-9/11 world we live in, and we must prevent an attack. And when we send people to their countries, but, of course, that we send people to countries that aren't theirs, he didn't address that, we seek assurances that no one will be tortured.
Right. I saw that. I thought that was one of the most mealy-mouthed mumbles I've seen in a long time.
Well, what's fascinating is that yesterday, when I wasn't on with you, Victoria was, I was up in another part of Congress speaking to the Egyptian ambassador to the United States, and I asked him about extraordinary rendition, and he said, essentially, he said, listen, he said, well, you know, we have laws that outlaw torture. And I said, well, so do we. And he said, exactly. He said, you do not need to be a member of the frequent flyer club. And what he essentially was saying is, look, you have laws against torture, so do we. And without saying it, he said, and we all do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and surprise, surprise, right? I mean, this is, yeah. Okay. So, and you were at that press conference this morning. I'm wondering.
Well, as you know, in fact, the last question, he stopped. I mean, they put you in a row. You see, I don't get to choose where I sit. So they put me in a row where they basically knew, that I would not get a question.
Well, in fact, he has a seating chart in front of him.
Doesn't he have a list of the order in which he's supposed to call in to ask him a question?
Right. He has a list of the people that he's supposed to ask questions of and the order in which he's going to ask them. And that's how he knows the name of a lot of people that he doesn't actually know the names of, because they're sitting in seat 17 and it says, you know,
well,
the fourth person you call on is Ralph.
Also had a seating chart. However, he went into the audience and he often had a photo of somebody in front of him so that he could look at the photo, look at the name, see where they were. There was also set seats in Clinton's press conferences, but he was much more generous in terms of reaching out into the crowd.
Yeah. Well, were there any ringers, any Jeff Gannons in the crowd today, Ellen?
Well, it's hard to know. I don't think so. One thing that I thought was pretty interesting, and again, what you get from covering the White House other than spoon-fed stuff, is that you begin to understand nuances. And when he talked about Social Security, this is really the first time he said very clearly, this is not going to fix Social Security.
Right. Yeah, although he said it in a way that I don't think the average American would understand. Because he didn't say...
It's pretty clear to me sitting in there.
Well, that was the question that the guy from CNN asked. He said, you know, when are you going to deal with the fact that private accounts aren't going to handle the shortfall? There's a word for it that I'm missing. And Bush kind of danced around it and offered his platitudes, but he agreed with him. But the bottom line is that nobody said right up, and Bush certainly didn't say, private accounts are not going to solve the problem of solvency.
That's right.
And
this is the first time he's come that close.
Yeah, well, it wasn't. It, unfortunately, I mean, watch ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN tonight. I don't think America is going to figure out what
you
and I figured
out. Well, they won't put it that way, but
yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, exactly.
It was there.
There you go.
It just will be hidden.
Yep, well said. Ellen, thanks so much for the report today. Great to hear from you.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio.
For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I had another dream about the lions at the door. They weren't half as frightening as they were before, but I'm thinking about eternity. So I'm gonna act as a guy.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth in Broadcasting, the pill that will help you escape the matrix that you might have felt you were caught in if you happened to watch Bush's press conference this morning. A doublespeak on parade. A few things to keep an eye out for. An EU team is visiting Washington right now, the European Union. They've sent some folks over to Washington, D.C. to talk about trade rules. This should be interesting. This is not an official WTO thing. This is the EU and the US. And here's the problem. The European Union bases their decisions about what can be sold, particularly consumables, things like genetically modified foods or chemicals or food additives. They base it on the precautionary principle. In other words, if you're going to put something in a human being's body, you have to prove it's safe. This is called the precautionary principle. And there's a lot of substances that are in the food in the United States, like growth hormones in meat, and certain kinds of artificial sweeteners, and you know, on and on, and genetically modified organisms that haven't been proven to be safe. And so the Europeans say, when you've proved it's safe on humans, come and talk to us. But for the moment, we're not taking this stuff. And in the United States, on the other hand, alone among industrialized worlds, pretty much alone, we say, you don't have to prove it's safe. If you're a big multinational corporation, you make donations to the administration. You can go ahead and sell it. And if we discover that it kills people, then we'll ask you to stop, as we have done over and over and over again. So the Europeans are coming over to discuss this with us at our request. And it's going to be interesting to see how this thing shakes out. The other areas that we want to talk with them about are airline passenger data information. This from Scott Miller and David Riley's report in today's Wall Street Journal. Airline pilot passenger data information. The United States, we are saying, hey, the government should be able to have all this, have the scoop on everybody. Big Brother should be watching. And the Europeans are saying, well, you know, we have this idea. You guys used to talk about it. We still do, called privacy. Again, yesterday, Mr. Bimbo on his show said, there is no specific right to privacy enumerated in the Constitution. In that, he was quoting Justice Scalia. No, there is not. The word privacy does not appear in the Constitution. Why? Because in 1787, when the Constitution was written, 1789, when the Bill of Rights was amended to it, the word privacy meant to use the toilet. And then in the late 1800s, when Thomas Crapper invented the flush toilet, a different word came to be used for that function. But back in the late 1700s, if you said, I need a moment of privacy, or excuse me, I would like some privacy, you meant that you wanted to go to the toilet. And yeah, it was just very simple. I have the collected writings of Thomas Jefferson, 17,000 letters, his autobiography, his daily journal, everything on a CD. You can find this, you can buy this thing. And the collected works of James Madison. And you do a keyword search in the word privacy. It does not exist. Now, these guys, they wrote a right of privacy into the Constitution. It's the Fourth Amendment. They just didn't call it privacy. They called it security. We're talking about how language has changed over 200 years. The Fourth Amendment, the right of persons to be secure in their persons, papers, and effects. Let me find the exact language, actually. It's a short one. I can share it with you. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. Unless you pass the Patriot Act, which says that you can do sneak and peek investigations where you go into people's houses without telling them, bloody, bloody, blah. Well, the Europeans still say, hey, this right to privacy, or as the founders called it, the right to security in your papers, effects, and home, this is something we still believe in, even though the Bush administration doesn't. And so they're having a discussion about that. The same with financial markets. To what extent can we swap information? India and Pakistan, I raised the issue of the U.S. fighter jets yesterday. I'll tell you about that in just a minute. Let's take a few phone calls here first. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Philip in St. Louis on the line. Hey, Philip, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to add to what your caller earlier said about businesses being part of the middle class. Not only are they part of the middle class, but they serve primarily the middle class and the lower class. And so if you cut the throats of the middle class and the lower class, small businesses are going to stumble. Consumer spending is the fuel of this economy. And the reason our economy keeps kind of surging forward and then falling off is because George Bush is basically blowing starter fluid in the engine instead of filling the gas tank.
Yeah, for sure, Philip. In fact, you know, the majority of jobs in the United States are created by companies with fewer than 100 employees. And the majority of companies in the United States have fewer than 50 employees. And you know what the average pay for the owner, the CEO of a company with 50 or fewer employees is in the United States?
I have no idea.
$56,000 a year.
Wow.
That's the average pay of the CEO of a company with 50 or fewer employees, $56,000 a year. There's a lot of people who are running small businesses and taking and making $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. They may have four or five employees. They're not making a whole lot, but they are creating jobs, and this is the engine that runs America. And small businesses, by definition, are middle America. Philip, thanks for the call, and thanks for making an excellent point and for having the patience to stick around and do it. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Philip in Abiquiu, New Mexico, if I'm pronouncing that correct. Chris.
Yeah, Chris is... hello, Tom. So good to be able to hear you in New Mexico again. It really is. I wanted to step back to the Wolfowitz thing for a second. I suppose we should be thankful that Bush didn't appoint Ken Lay to the position, or, you know.
He would have if he could have.
I imagine he probably would.
Actually, I suspect Ken Lay would have been up for, like, ambassador to Switzerland or something, you know, because usually what you pay off your wealthy patrons with ambassadorships because you know, it gives them status and it gives them a paid vacation at taxpayers' expense. And,
yeah.
You know, sort of
this,
that.
Along with Mr. Bolton and Condoleezza Rice being our. I maintain these people have no clue what diplomacy is. I mean, they may have a working knowledge of the definition of the dictionary, but they really don't know how to work anything diplomatically.
Yeah.
Elsewise, why would they be doing this?
Well, and this is why so many people in the State Department have been cringing, and actually why there was mass exodus from the State Department when the Bush administration came in and started, you know, their saber rattling and their, I mean, there have been some of our top senior diplomats, particularly around the time of the Iraq War, just said, that's it, I'm out, I'm retiring, I'm taking early retirement. These people are nuts.
Just like
they're doing in the CIA right now, because Porter Goss doesn't know anything about it. Well, you could say he doesn't know anything about intelligence. He was the head of the Intelligence Committee, but he clearly has a political agenda. He's KGB-ifying the CIA and the intelligence community. If you're not part of the party line, you're out. And people are wondering why there were all these firings and all these resignations at the very high levels in the CIA when Porter Goss came in. It was the exact same thing happened with the KGB when Vlad Putin took it over.
You have yourself a good day, my friend.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. I appreciate the call. You always make a good point. Okay, here's the thing with India and Pakistan. Yesterday I shared this story with you that Condi is going over to Southern Asia, the Indian subcontinent, it's not Southeastern Asia like Vietnam, it's India and Pakistan and another part of the southern part of Asia. As part of this trip, and it was being presented in the news as Condi does diplomacy. But really, it turned out, we discovered in this reporting that was actually, as I recall, in the Wall Street Journal, that the main thing was that Lockheed was saying that if they didn't sell some F-16s to Pakistan or India, they were going to close their factories in Texas. And if they did sell some F-16s to Pakistan or India, then they would keep their factories open for at least a couple of years, but then they would move the production over to India, where they can make them cheaper. But that would be after the 2008 election. So Condi's going over there trying to sell some F-16s, because one of the, you know, part of the agenda of this administration, and truth be told, it was part of the agenda of the Clinton administration before it, the Bush administration before that, the Reagan administration before that, to some extent even the Carter administration and Ford. And I mean, this has been going on for a while. This is what Eisenhower warned us against. He was probably the last president to resist this kind of thing. Part of the, quote, diplomatic policy, diplomatic work, end quote, that is being done by representatives of the administration is to advance the interests of multinational corporations, big corporations, large contributors, large political contributors in the United States, like Lockheed, for example, and Boeing and so on and so forth. So now India says, this in today's Wall Street Journal, Jay Solomon in New Delhi, and Zahid Hussain in Islamabad, Pakistan, contributed to this report. India is saying, you know, we're not sure we're interested in buying your F-16s. Now, Pakistan wants them. Pakistan's been desperately trying to get them. And we have not been selling them to them because Musharraf, you know, I mean, it was a brutal overthrow of an elected government. The guy's a dictator. Oh, but freedom's on the march. No, but our main ally's a dictator. But freedom's on the march. But our main ally's a dictator. Well, ignore that man behind the curtain. Yeah. Well, we haven't sold him F-16s up to this point, which he has been salivating over. Because the guy's a dictator, he's got nuclear weapons, he's got an unstable country, he overthrew a democratically elected administration in Pakistan. But now we're thinking about selling them F-16s because Lockheed is saying, if you don't find us some customers, we're going to shut down our factories in Texas. And so Condi's going over, but India in the meantime is in the process right now, as we speak, of cutting deals or negotiating deals with Sweden, France, and Russia for up to 200 new jets. The Wall Street Journal notes the tentative plans call for the U.S. to sell Pakistan about 24 of the jets, which are made by Lockheed Martin Corp. The Indians could buy as many as 125 if they settle on the F-16, but as they note in this report in the Wall Street Journal, Indian officials voiced wariness yesterday of being dependent on Washington for its arms. They would just as soon not depend on us. What I think is dawning on Europeans is certainly well known by Asians, particularly the Chinese and the Japanese, is dawning on Europeans and is just beginning to make the glimmering edge of daylight, of just the glimmering little bit of realization of Americans, of some Americans, is that the Bush administration and the conservative economic and foreign policies that really started with Reagan, Bush Sr., to a large extent Clinton, the new Democrats, and certainly George W., that these policies have so weakened the United States. We have gone from being the largest creditor in the world to being the largest debtor in the world. Used to be most people bought things from us and owed us money. Now we buy things from them and we owe them money. We owe more countries more money than anybody in the world. We used to be, before Reagan, we were the world's manufacturing powerhouse. And we had been for a century. And Reagan came along and changed all that. And you see, the definition of a banana republic is a country that exports its raw materials. And there's a limit to how long you can export your raw materials. Eventually, if it's minerals, eventually you run out of them. If it's food, eventually your soil gets depleted. You're basically giving away your wealth when you export your raw materials. Whereas if you do like Japan doesn't have any raw materials. They don't have any, very little natural wealth. They have enough land to grow enough rice to feed their people. That's about it. That and seafood, the ocean around them. And they've been doing okay on that for a few thousand years. But basically, they've accumulated the enormous wealth that they have by adding value to other people's raw material. They buy steel from us or metals, and they turn them into Walkmen or cars. They add value. They add intellectual value. They add labor value. It's called manufacturing. And that's how Japan has become wealthy. That's how the United States became wealthy. That's why we had a strong middle class from the 1940s until Reagan became president. And with voodoo economics now, through Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush, we have seen the destruction of this to the point now, as I said, it's starting to dawn on Americans that we are not the richest and most powerful nation in the world any longer. We are by no means the richest nation in the world. We are the most indebted nation in the world. Just in terms of our trade deficit, every man, woman in America owes the rest of the world $10,000. That's how much we have bought from other countries and borrowed from them to buy. It's like as a nation, we're living on our credit card, and the bank that holds the credit card is China, Japan, Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, pretty much in that order. And then not to mention the $35,000, $40,000 in debt that George W. and Ronnie Reagan ran up to try and make the economy look good so that they could hand off cash to their rich buddies, their millionaires and billionaire buddies. They're running us into the ground, my friends. We have to take this country back before they totally ruin it. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lindball.
This is the old...
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Homeless, moonlight sleeping on a midnight day.
Somebody say, somebody sing,
hello, hello, hello.
Somebody say,
and welcome back. Yeah, keep singing there. 5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. Speaking of which, Kim in Denver, Colorado on the line. Hey, Kim.
Hi.
What's up?
Just wondered if you were aware that the Canadian seal hunt is going to begin in the beginning of April.
Yes, the baby seal hunt.
Yeah, well, there are adults killed also, but we're trying to get as many protest letters as possible to the Canadian government and petitions. You can go to the seashepherd.org website or the International Fund for Animal Welfare website.
Mm-hmm.
That's ifaw.org.
Okay.
And take action there.
When's this going to start, Kim?
About April 1st.
But so we've got a few weeks for those folks who are concerned about this issue. This is...
Yeah, there were protests across the nation at the Canadian embassies, and I got 32 signatures in just 40 minutes on a petition, which I mailed to Paul Martin, who's the Prime Minister of Canada.
Now, Sue, just to play devil's advocate for a moment, is this hunt going to endanger the species?
They're saying, yeah, it's going to make a real dent. They're trying to take, like, over a million animals over a few years. And it could seriously impact the seal population.
So this is very different than, for example, our annual harvest of tens to perhaps hundreds of millions of cows and pigs.
You mean in just the slaughterhouses,
right,
of the U.S.?
Yeah, which I have a problem with, frankly.
They're brutal. They're completely brutal. The way that they're killed.
Here I am being the actual liberal that fits the stereotype, having been a vegetarian for 30 some odd years. But, you know,
excellent.
I agree with the seal hunt, but it sometimes seems to me that folks get upset about the killing of animals that are cute, and they don't get upset about the killing of animals that they think of as lunch. And that seems hypocritical.
Yeah, the cuteness is just a side issue. The brutality is unmatched anywhere in the world.
Yeah. Because they're clubbing them.
Well, they skin them alive.
They do, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had heard reports of that. I've seen the photos over the years, but I didn't realize they were still doing that. I figured that by now they had come up with something a little more humane.
If people could protest this, we've got to get it stopped.
Yeah, seems unnecessary. Okay, Kim, plug the website one last time here. We got about 10 seconds.
SeaShepherd.org or ifaw.org.
IF as in Frank, AW?
Yes, International Fund for Animal Welfare.
Great. Kim, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for the details and the info and raising an interesting topic. Tom Hartman here with you. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, news without conflicts of global corporate interest, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. Interesting little piece in the international section, the World Watch section, it's called, of today's Wall Street Journal. It's sort of the, you know, half the story kind of thing. And I don't mean that as a criticism of the Wall Street Journal. I mean, their business isn't to provide in these short Dow Jones Newswire pieces the entire history of every single story. But I will share with you the other half of the history. You will recall, in fact, I'll give you the history in advance and then give you the story from the Wall Street Journal. You will recall that some years ago, 6, 8, 10 years ago, something like that, I don't recall the exact year, Argentina decided to privatize their state, what they call the state pension system, which we would call Social Security. And the private banks came in and took this thing over. And, of course, the government had to borrow lots and lots of money to fund the transition to private accounts, just like Bush is proposing to do. He's talking about borrowing $2 trillion. Keep in mind that when Ronald Reagan became president, in the entire history of the United States, we had never borrowed even $1 trillion. Through two world wars, a civil war, revolution, we had never borrowed even $1 trillion. Ronald Reagan came into office and our national debt was in the neighborhood of the low $900 billion. And Reagan was the first president to take it past $1 trillion and then past $2 trillion and then into the range of $3 trillion, borrowing like crazy so that in 1984 he could get reelected because he made the economy look good. Because he borrowed all that money and spent it like crazy, and it made things look good. And he didn't have to raise taxes. Why not? Because he borrowed it. And who's paying for that? Well, right now, a good chunk of the taxes being taken out of your paycheck are going to pay the interest on the money that Ronald Reagan borrowed. $160 billion this year. And Bush has got us up now to $7 trillion. In the 25 years since Reagan came in, the only president to have actually reversed the process of presidential or of government borrowing was Clinton. He actually generated what looked like a surplus. It was actually more like a break even because they were still, you know, they still weren't including the Social Security Trust Fund in that. But I digress. Anyhow, Argentina borrowed all this money and they privatized their Social Security system and they had their economy was going just rip roaring along. It was just everything was just fine and they thought this is great. And then the stock market hit a little bump in Argentina, in fact, around the world. And all this money that the Argentines had invested in the stock market started becoming worth less. And this produced a run on the banks, and it produced a crash in the Argentine economy. The economy, their economy went in the toilet. I mean, it just went in the tank. It fell apart. It was the end of the Argentine economy. Because they privatized Social Security. That's what was caused it. The Argentinians privatized Social Security and their economy went off the rails. I was down in Buenos Aires about 4 years ago. Stayed with a family, some friends we have down there. Argentinians. And it's like you can't find a job. Things are tough. And this was in a nice middle-class neighborhood, and people were selling their furniture in their front yards. I mean, just to get money to buy food. Not the people I was staying with, but I mean, around, you know, this you see this all over the country. Well, today in the paper, brought to you by Social Security privatization, today in the paper, in the Wall Street Journal, Dow Jones Newswires, Argentine poverty rate falls, but still tops 40%. Dateline Buenos Aires. Argentine's poverty rate slid in the second half of 2004, ending the year at 40.2%, compared with 44.3% in the first half of the year. Isn't this great news? This is the National Statistics Agency of Argentina. It's called INDEC, I-N-D-E-C. They define poverty as the inability to afford a basic basket of food and services. In other words, you can't pay your rent and eat. 40% of all the residents of Argentina. They have a new president, President Néstor Kirchner, and he came into power basically a few years ago saying, okay, we are going to say to the World Bank and the IMF and all of our creditors, tough luck, guys. You're going to have to wait for your money. We're putting our country together first. Because a lot of that money that they borrowed in order to privatize Social Security, they borrowed from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So they know social welfare has been one of the main agenda items for President Néstor Kirchner, who used the country's still high poverty and unemployment rates as reasons why foreign creditors shouldn't have demanded more during the government's $103 billion debt restructuring, which closed last month. Remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. Now, the basic food basket that they're talking about, by the way, cost $37.37 in Greater Buenos Aires in December of 2004. They don't say over what period of time that is, so I don't have a context to provide for you on this. But it's interesting to look at the graph of consumer prices. In Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela. Well, anyhow, we're starting to get a little arcane here. But the point is, privatize Social Security, run your country into bankruptcy. And it takes a decade or two to get out of it. I'll bet you won't see that tonight on the NBC Evening News with Brian Williams, who says that his duty is to listen to the Rush Limbaugh program. Or CBS with George Bush's good friend Bob Schieffer. Or ABC with Peter Jennings, who I have yet to figure out a good reason to criticize, other than the fact that his company is owned by a big multinational conglomerate. But I'll come up with something. Oh, my. Our telephone number, 1-866. Toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894, if you would like to call in. The chat room, if you want to drop into the chat room and say hello to some of the finest minds on the Internet, go to TomHartmann.com, click Live Chat. It'll take you to our message board, click Live Chat there, and boom, it will drop you into our chat room. If you have pop-up software, we don't throw pop-ups, but in order to register, it pops up a window. So you have to hold down the control key when you click the register button. And then you can put in your email address and boom, you're there. It's easy. It's free. It's fun. Yes. Moondog says, hello, finest minds on the Internet. Maine, give me a reason why Peter Jennings is terrible. I'd love to know. Anyway, back to the telephones. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Dave in Northern California on the line. Hey, Dave, listening on what, KGOE there?
KGOE, Tom.
What's up, Dave?
Well, I can't begin to tell you how unhappy, how angry we are up here with this neocon takeover of our country and what they're trying to do to us. I wanted to tell you about, we fully expect a pretty major turnout of very unhappy, angry people in our peace march. But you just brought up another subject, if I might. A lot of these big crooked corporations that contribute money to this group, they are in effect buying the right to rip off the public. And if you'd like one example you're going to be speaking of, Walmart. One of the things they do is offer an ISP service. If you want it, it's a pretty reasonable price, and you get a free trial period. If you decide it's not what you want and you quit it, You will find months later they are billing your bank account. You call them and you explain that you do not want the service, you haven't used it, and they'll confirm it. And a year later, you'll find, my God, that's still being billed. And
you know, I got to tell you, Dave, I had the exact same problem with AOL. And I finally had to call my credit card company and report my credit card stolen and ask them to give me a new credit card number.
AOL and Walmart Connect is one and the same, and they both pay off the same crooked government.
Yeah, well, I don't want to indict them for criminal activity or anything. I'm just saying, you know, this, I had the same experience, and the only way I could, and after literally a half a dozen calls saying, please cancel my account, over a period of several months, finally, I called my credit card company and I said, you know, it didn't say it was stolen. I said, I'd lost it. I've lost my credit card someplace. I'm not sure where. This is not some kind of theft alert or anything. They went over my charges with me and everything, you know, and I said, it looks like everything's fine. I said, but please issue me a new credit card with a new number because this thing might be sitting, you know, I might have left it on the counter at the restaurant or something. And I had to make that up. You know, I couldn't say, hey, issue me new, and because AOL won't stop billing me. In fact, I had called my credit card company and said, please take this off my bill. And they said that they would. And maybe they did for 1 month, but it appeared the next month again. So finally, when I said, you know, my credit card company, I lost my credit card, give me a new number. And they gave me a new number. And that's the only way that I was able to figure out how to get them to stop billing.
Well, WM Connect is an affiliate of AOL. It's the same crooked operation. You will call the same Pakistan group when you call for your Walmart, as you do
well,
for you.
You know, let's be careful here, Dave. I'm not sure. I can't say that this is crooked. I just think that it's lousy customer service.
Well, you're a very cautious man, Tom.
Well, they have more lawyers than I do. One, but two, I really think that it's important that we not engage in hyperbole and that we do, you know, call these things straight. The fact of the matter is that they're playing by the rules. What we need to do is change the rules. If there was a law that said that if you call a company and you say, please cancel my service for something, whether it's an ISP or whether it's a magazine subscription, if you call a company and cancel it and they fail to cancel it, then they get hit with some kind of a significant penalty. If we had good, strong consumer protection laws, this would not be an issue. But the fact of the matter is that they're operating within the law. And so, you know, I mean, we can sit around and complain about it, but I don't think we can call them criminal.
Well, maybe you got a class action lawyer out there that'd like to own a piece of Walmart.
Well, except for the fact that the Republicans just last month took away our right to have class action lawsuits at the state level.
Oh.
Remember?
Oh, that's right, yeah. We're going to have a hell of a nice pizza
now,
up here.
So now your only choice, Dave, is if they keep billing you and you run out of money, declare bankruptcy. Oh, wait a minute. They just took that away, too, didn't they?
I don't like these people. We're going to have a heck of a big peace march up here.
Okay, great. Well, I hope you have a great time with it, and the next week you'll call us and let us know how it went.
Will do.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Always good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. The telephone number here, truth, and common sense in broadcasting. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Well, it was 1960, the year that President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon set aside 19 million acres of wilderness in northern Alaska and called it the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR. And the Republicans knew that if they put forward a bill like they had done in previous years to say, okay, let's turn this thing over to our good buddies in the oil industry so that they can pump some of the oil out of there and make billions of dollars in profits, that it would get shot down, that the Democrats would vote against it. And, in fact, they might even filibuster. It would take 60 votes to get it through because the Democrats would call for a filibuster, and that would be the end of that because they've done it before. See, the problem is, first of all, the amount of oil that's up there is really only enough to run this country for, you know, a month or two, if it was the only thing that was running the country. It represents perhaps as much as 2% of the oil that we use. It's relatively insignificant. It certainly is. It's the amount of oil that we'll get out of Anwar is less than the amount of oil that we would save if we simply eliminated the tax deduction, the $100,000 a year tax deduction on SUVs. Said the fleet mileage on cars in the United States has to be 3 miles per gallon higher than it is right now. Do those two things, and you've got all the oil in Anwar. And you would actually spur economic growth in the United States because you'd be pushing new technologies. This is what's happened in the past when we've increased the CAFE standards, the car fleet standards, fuel efficiency standards. But even though it's an insignificant amount of oil, and even though it runs the risk of ruining a pristine part of the United States, there are billions of dollars in profits to be made. You see, this is virgin oil. When you start pumping oil out of a well that's been pumping for a while, like in Saudi Arabia right now, it costs anywhere from $5 to $8 a barrel to pump that oil in Saudi Arabia because they're having to suck pretty hard on that straw. We have wells in California that are reaching the halfway point. It's costing $15, $20 a barrel to suck out of them. There are old wells in the Midwest and Texas that have been capped because it's costing $30, $40 a barrel to draw the oil out of them. The amount of energy that it takes to suck so hard on that straw, because there's just not that much oil left. Or they have to pump steam down into them, or hot water, or some other, there's other ways to do it, down into them to get the oil out, and it's expensive. But when you first tap a brand new reserve, that oil just comes bubbling up to the surface. And it costs $1, $1.50 a barrel to take it. It's really cheap oil. So you've got oil, for example, in Iraq. Iraqi oil costs on an average $1.50 a barrel. And you can sell it for $54 a barrel. It's incredibly profitable. Because the oil fields have not been heavily exploited like they have been in Saudi Arabia and many of the other Arab countries. Well, so there's a lot of profit to be made out of northern Alaska. Not a whole lot of oil, but it does represent billions of dollars in profit. And so the oil companies are willing to invest a few million dollars to buy some politicians. And the Republicans have always been saying, hey, here's the hand, just cross it with cash. The vote 51 to 49 in the Senate, not to remove from an appropriations bill a rider that would allow drilling in Anwar. So if they pass the budget, which they will, then drilling in Anwar will be approved. This battle by kind of a backdoor procedure. The Republicans were not willing to put this thing up for a straight up or down vote because they knew that they would lose that. So they slapped it onto this spending bill, and the Democrats tried to pull it off, remove it, and they just lost just minutes ago. 51 to 49 in the Senate. Money rules in Bush world. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con in conservative.
Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, baby, baby, it's a wild world.
At least Bush world is. No, it's got to be more than a smile. We got to get politically active here. Barbara Boxer sent this email out. I'm on her list. I suppose anybody who signs up at packforchange.com can get on the list. Barbara Boxer, the lead Democratic senator who has, how do you say it without sounding sexist, who has fortitude, who has courage, who is willing to stand up and speak out on controversial issues like the theft of the vote in Ohio. Anyhow, she had put together this petition to send to Senator Bill Frist, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, the doctor whose family made its fortune and whose family's company paid I think it was $800 million fine for fraud, Medicare fraud, as I recall. Bill Frist, who's made his fortune basically sucking blood out of previously not-for-profit hospitals, converting them to for-profit hospitals. And you wonder why we have lousy health care in the United States. Talk to Bill Frist. In any case, she had put this thing together, this petition to send to him, and I tried to sign it. They had this online thing, and I clicked the online thing, and I signed the petition, and, you know, he gave him my information, my address and email address and everything, and said, send it to Bill Frist. And I got a message back saying his email box is full and is not accepting any more petitions. So, you know, it said, please print it out and mail it. Well, the vote was today. I signed the petition yesterday. But in any case, Barbara Boxer said, dear Thomas, thank you so much for your support. More than 21,000 Americans, including you, have already come forward to sign my petition and demand that Senate Republican leader Bill Frist halt efforts. Now, this was received a few hours ago. Halt efforts to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling, but we've got to do more. In the final hours of this critical debate on the Senate floor, I'm appealing for your help. She said, right-wing Republicans... Right-wing Republicans, I would say, are trying to hijack the legislative process by sneaking this ANWR provision into the budget bill. It has no business in the budget bill, but they know they can't get it passed any other way. That's true. She says, well, we can't let them get away with this. Opening ANWR to drilling is bad for our environment. Opening ANWR to drilling will not lower gas prices. Opening ANWR to drilling won't produce more than 6 months' worth of oil. And by the way, it's going to be somewhere between 5 and 10 years before we see any of that oil. Opening ANWR to drilling won't produce, well, here's the next sentence. Opening ANWR to drilling won't even produce any oil for 10 years, but it will put our environment at risk right away. Opening ANWR to drilling won't solve our energy problems, but developing alternative energy sources, raising fuel efficiency standards of SUVs and automobiles, and other common sense approaches can. And opening ANWR to drilling sets a terrible precedent. What's next? Yosemite, the Grand Canyon, the Florida coastline? Well, it won't be the Florida coastline. Jeb Bush has already put a stop to that. They actually have found oil off the coast of Florida. But it ain't being drilled. No siree. That's Bush world. Stand up against Bill Frist. Back to Barbara Boxer. Stand up against Bill Frist and right-wing Republican efforts to open up the Alaskan wilderness for oil drilling. Invite everyone you know to sign my petition today. Unfortunately, I just got this email. For some reason, ever since the Patriot Act was passed, sometimes it takes me a day or two to get email. It's really weird. I can send myself three emails, and two of them will come right away, and the next one comes the next day at 4 o'clock. Go figure. No, I'm not paranoid. I'm just, you know, maybe it's probably just one of the weirdnesses of the Internet. She says, help us preserve this pristine Alaskan wilderness area and let the Republican leadership know that we won't forget the votes they cast. And that has to be, you know, what ultimately we have to say about this is that we won't forget the vote that these guys have cast on this thing. We are not going to forget this. Ain't going to happen. Senator Richard Durbin said that even a peak production of the refuge would account for less than 2.5% of U.S. energy oil needs. How in the world can this be the centerpiece of our energy policy? Asked Durbin, arguing that more conservation, more fuel-efficient automobiles would save more oil than the Alaska refuge would produce. However, New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici, a supporter of drilling, said the refuge's oil represents, quote, the most significant onshore production capacity in the country. We should do everything we can to produce as much as we can. End of quote. If this is the most significant onshore production capacity that we have, 6 months worth of oil, my friends, we are in deep trouble. You want to talk crisis, Mr. Bush? Let's stop talking about Social Security and let's start talking about peak oil. Let's start talking about the real crisis. Well, and the next one coming up, and this will be the next one coming up. I'm telling you, this is our conservative alert for the day, as they are wont to do. The cons are at it again. This is from conservativealerts.com, rightmarch.com. Alert! The far leftists at MoveOn.org are at it again, and this time they want to stop President Bush from nominating solid conservative judges to the Supreme Court and other federal seats. So we need to stop them by getting senators to change one Senate rule and stopping their judicial filibuster. Yes, these folks want to roll back a rule that's been in place 200 years. Leading the charge at MoveOn's rally will be Senator Robert KKK Byrd. The same Senator Byrd who once said regarding filibuster rules, this Congress is not obliged to be bound by the dead hand of the past.
Jeez.
This is so tragic. Over 60 conservative groups, they say, have declared today a day of protest against the unconstitutional filibuster of qualified conservative judicial nominees. Qualified conservative judicial nominees. Well, let's take a look at some of these folks. First of all, for those of you who don't know what a filibuster is when somebody just keeps on talking and doesn't stop, and so the other person, so business doesn't get done. And this has been used in the Senate for 200 years as a way of protecting the rights of the minority from the projected power of the majority. So if at least 41 senators, this from there's a nice background of the people from the American Way put together, pfaw.org. If at least 41 senators strongly oppose a bill or nominee, they can vote to continue debate or block a final vote on that issue. It's called a filibuster. And the only way to break a filibuster is if you can get 60 votes. There's 100 people in the Senate, two from each state. There's 100 senators. So it takes 60 votes. And this has been the case for two centuries. Now, the U.S. Constitution explicitly says that senators have the vital responsibility and the power to confirm or reject the president's nominees to our federal court. This is in Article 2, Section 2 of the United States Constitution. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct number of electors equal to... But no senator or representative or person holding any office or trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector. Section 2, Article 2? That must be wrong, because I've got... Oh, that's Section 1. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong part. Here we are. Section 2. Oh, that's rather long. I don't have to read the whole thing, but... here it is. The point of it is that the Senate... Here we go. They're talking about the president. He shall have the power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur, and he shall nominate, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, he shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and councils, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herewith and otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. But the advice and the consent of the Senate. And the rule for 200 years now has been, if 41 senators say no, then it takes a vote of 60 senators to overturn that. And the cons want to do away with this. Specifically, Bill Frist. Even Orrin Hatch has said the filibuster, and I'm quoting now Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, outgoing Republican chairman of the Judiciary Committee. One of the few tools that the minority has to protect itself and those the minority represents. Now, keep in mind, more Americans voted for Democratic senators in 2004 than voted for Republican senators. Say what? Why aren't there more Democratic senators than Republican senators? Well, because each state has two senators. It has nothing to do with the size of the state. A little tiny state like Vermont, we have 600,000 people, we have two senators. A great big state like California, what is it, 34 million people in California? They have two senators. But if you look at the actual number of people who voted for Democratic senators versus Republican senators, more people voted for Democratic senators than for Republican senators in 2004. And yet the Republican senators want to run roughshod over this, and they want to get these so-called qualified conservative judges in. Let's take a look at some of these folks. Janice Rogers Brown. They want to nominate her to the First Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the District of Columbia. This is the court from which very often Supreme Court justices are taken. This from People for the American Way. In speeches as well as in some of her opinions, Brown has embraced extreme anti-federal government positions, what she called the Revolution of 1937. You know what happened in 1937? We got things like minimum wage laws and Social Security. The Revolution of 1937, when the Supreme Court began to consistently sustain New Deal legislation against legal attack, was in her mind a, quote, disaster that marked, and quoting Judge Janice Rogers Brown, the triumph of our socialist revolution, end quote. This is a judge who thinks that Social Security is socialism, who thinks that minimum wage laws are socialism, who thinks that child labor laws are socialism, who thinks that protecting workers and workers' rights are socialism. The American Bar Association, not exactly a socialist organization. In fact, if anything, a by and large conservative organization, the American Bar Association gave her a rating of qualified / not qualified. That's sort of like a D. Like a C would be qualified, an A would be super qualified, a B would be sort of qualified, and an F would be not qualified. They give her a qualified / not qualified. And she's a real winner. Justice Janice Rogers Brown. I have the problem I have with this. Here we go. She argued that private property owners should be able to effectively veto almost any government regulation affecting them unless they agree it would benefit them economically. In other words, if we the people get together and say, we don't think that toxic waste dumps in our community are helpful for us, particularly if they're leaching toxins into the ground, we cannot pass that regulation. As long as the toxic waste disposal company can prove that they can make money doing it, according to Judge Janice Rogers Brown. The majority characterized her dissent as an effort to impose a personal theory of political economy on the people of a democratic state, contrary to established precedent. She suggested that racially discriminatory speech in the workplace, even if it rises to the level of illegal harassment, is protected by the First Amendment and cannot be limited. In another case, she signaled her approval of broad on-the-job drug testing, even in situations in which a majority of the California Supreme Court found the test to be unconstitutional. She's all in favor of Big Brother in our bedrooms and in our bodies and in our bathrooms. She is not in favor of Big Brother protecting the little guy. That's one of the highly qualified judges that the Senate rejected that George Bush has sent back up all over again. Good old Janice Rogers Brown. Here's another one. William Haynes. He's the principal author and defender of the administration's designation and handling of enemy combatants. He came up with this phrase. And the denial of Geneva Convention protections to persons captured on the battlefield. Good old William Haynes. Yes, we really need him. Maybe we can get him on the Supreme Court one of these days, right? Wouldn't that be cool? Say the cons. How about William Pryor? He vigorously defended Alabama's practice of handcuffing prison inmates to hitching posts in the hot sun for hours as punishment. Nothing wrong with that. He's the leader of the modern states' rights movement. He's argued that the Constitution should not apply to things like reproductive choice, gay rights, or school prayer. These matters should be decided by the states based on a majority vote, regardless of whether constitutional rights are violated. Good old William Pryor. He called Roe v. Wade the worst abomination of constitutional law in our history. This is the guy they want to send up to the Supreme Court next. I'm telling you, he also believes that it is constitutional to put into prison gay men and lesbians for having sex in the privacy of their own homes. If you happen to be gay or lesbian and you have sex in your own home with a consenting adult, according to this guy, William Pryor, you go to prison 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper.
Yes, it's what it's going to take, a revolution at the polling place. Although first we've got to get these voting machines accountable to nobody and run by Republican corporations out of the way. Let's take the vote back. Let's take our country back. William Myers, another one of the right-wing cranks that George W. Bush has said, hey, let's send this guy back up again. He filed amicus briefs before the Supreme Court that would have severely diminished congressional authority to pass legislation to protect the health and safety of Americans. In one brief, he argued there was no constitutional basis. That's his language. No constitutional basis for federal authority to protect wetlands under the Clean Water Act. It's not in the Constitution, therefore, doesn't say in the Constitution that we, the people, have the right to protect our own wetlands, our own, you know, the kidneys of our nation. Therefore, if big developer wants to go in and wipe out the wetlands, hey, there's money to be made. We're all in favor of it. Actually, that's not all that odd when you consider that William Myers, who Bush has renominated to the Ninth Circuit, before he became a judge, had another job. Guess what that might be? Mr. Richard Myers. Just what do you think his job might have been? Do you think he was a greeter at Walmart? No. Maybe he was a lawyer defending death row inmate? No. No, actually, he spent most of his career as a lobbyist for the mining, grazing, and cattle industries. George W. Bush wants to put a career lobbyist for the mining, grazing, and cattle industries into a lifetime seat on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, one seat away from the United States Supreme Court. Or how about Terrence Boyle? He has vigorously advocated that states' rights should trump state obligations to avoid discrimination based on race, gender, and disability. Great guy, that Terrence Boyle. He actually suggested in one case that states are not obliged to adhere to federal legal standards of equal opportunity for women in hiring in some positions where a state's, quote, culture, end quote, discourages women from working in that particular field. Oh, the culture of Alabama says that only women should be secretaries, for example. Do you get the kind of people that they're setting up here? I mean, this is just absolutely incredible. Terrence Boyle. Priscilla Owen, she was so radical that her Texas Supreme Court colleague, Alberto Gonzalez, said that adopting her view of the other dissenters would be an unconscionable act of judicial activism. This, her dissent in a Texas Supreme Court case. Priscilla Owen, we have heard about before. She's consistently issued dissents favoring business and government over consumers. Now, she wasn't a lobbyist. She just dreams of becoming one. It's Janice Rogers Brown. She says the government should abandon its test for distinguishing between private and corporate speech and allow corporations to make false and misleading representations with no legal ramifications at all.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Welcome to Bush World. We'll see you tomorrow.